Hi, everybody. Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is the founder of Advanced Audio Microphones, Dave Thomas. He's going to talk all about vintage microphones and the new versions of vintage microphones, the ones that we love so much. But first, let's talk about the music tastes of America. Nielsen Music just came out with a brand new report. This is their yearly report called Nielsen Music 360. And they look at the music tastes of Americans. And this is what they found. Very interesting. First of all, 93% of all Americans listen to music. And they spend 25 hours a week or more doing so. That in itself is pretty cool, but if you break that down a little further, you find out that 75% of Americans would rather listen to music than watch television. Sounds a little high to me, but that's what the report says. Now, how do we listen to music? 23% of us listen mostly in our car. 16% listen while working. About 15% listen while doing chores at home. Other activities are 13%, and exercising is only 12%. I would have thought that would have been a lot higher. Radio is the top delivery system at 59%. So in other words, most of us hear music, or the most of the music that we get comes from radio. And this is a figure that we know, we keep on hearing, and everybody kind of ignores because radio is such an old traditional medium, and we like to think that everyone is so hip. But in fact, that's not the case at all. 48% get most of their music from their own personal libraries. And once again, this seems to fly in the face of what we're being told by the media, where streaming is everything. But in fact, we're still listening to downloads, listening to those downloads that we purchased some time ago. 41% of us get most of our music from on-demand streaming like Spotify, while 36% of us get most of our music from radio-like streaming, like Pandora, for instance, or iTunes Radio. Now, this is pretty cool, actually, this figure. 18% purchase a song while listening to it. So in other words, people that are streaming, if they like a song, they'll actually buy it. That's a lot higher than I think anybody thought. And finally, 39% of smartphone users purchased music. So what the Music 360 report is basically telling us is people are still buying music, even though the world looks like it's going to streaming very, very quickly. People are still buying music. They're still downloading it. And of course, they still buy CDs. There were 232 million CDs sold in 2013. And that's the ones that we can count. And of course, which means there's still a lot of CDs being bought. The next thing I want to talk about is dealing with problem clients. Everybody in the music industry has to serve someone. So if you're in a band, you're basically serving your bandmates, or you're serving the artist, for instance, that you're working with. If you're a studio musician, you're serving the artist. If you're an engineer, you're serving the producer. If you're a producer, you're serving the artist and the record label. And if you're an artist, you're serving someone at the record label. You're serving the record label. And if you work at a record label, then you always have a boss. And even if you're the president of the label, you have to answer to the board of directors. We all answer to someone. We all serve someone. So that being said, sooner or later, we're going to run into some sort of problems with the people that we serve. And really, there are four ways that we can avoid any problems. The first thing is set the ground rules right at the onset of working with someone. And what this means is, if you're a mixer, for instance, you tell your client right up front, look, I'm going to give you the mix and I'm going to give you two revisions. And after that, you have to pay for it. By being very specific like that, you find that you eliminate many of the problems right up front. If you're a musician that's being hired for a showcase, you'll say right up front, okay, this is how much I want to get paid for the gig, and I will give you X number of rehearsals as well on top of that. And if you want me any more, you have to pay for it. So by being very specific, you find out that a lot of these problems can be mitigated before they even happen. And that's what we're trying to do. So first thing we want to do is set the ground rules so we can keep any problems from arising in the first place. The second thing is to really listen to any complaints or concerns that your client might have. And sometimes you'll find that the client is simply venting because something isn't going well. sometimes the client really doesn't understand what the problem is. So the worst thing you can do is get defensive without listening to what's going on. Sometimes the venting, sometimes the complaints are not about you. But many times, if you don't listen, you think that something is directed to you when it's really not. Sometimes the client is trying to send a message to someone else in the band, for instance, or someone else on the project, and knows that one of the best ways to do it is to talk at someone else who may be a little less inclined of getting defensive. So the best thing you can do is really, really listen to what any complaints or concerns are. The third thing is help find a solution. When you're alerted that there is a problem, the thing that you should do is really try to help the client find a solution. Help them get what they want. Because, once again, if they're your client, you're serving them. If we're serving them, what we're trying to do is help them realize their vision. Sometimes your vision is not what their vision is. You don't share it, but that doesn't matter. If they're your client, if they're paying you, you have to help them realize their vision. So that's number three, help find a solution. And of course, number four is the very, very last resort, and that's fire the client. So there comes a point in time where you just find that you cannot deal with the client or they can't deal with you. Then you have really nothing else you can do except fire the client at that point. Now, there's a way to do it. And the best way is to be very, very calm. Don't get defensive again and say something like, look, I'm not the person for the job. It's very obvious. So let me help you find somebody else. The last thing you want to do is burn any bridges. And there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, if you do this well, you never know. You may get hired someday again by this client down the road. But don't forget, there's also a lot of other people in the room. And one of those people may hire you as well down the road. If you fire the client, if you quit, if you do something in a very, very bad way, you have less of a chance of being hired by those people as well. So what you should do is make sure you keep a level head and fire the client in a very kind and gentle way. And then everybody wins. So you have a problem with the client? There are four things. First of all, set the ground rules right at the outset. Second thing is really listen to any of the complaints or concerns to make sure that they're addressed directly to you. The third thing is help your client find a solution. And if all else fails, fire the client. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbiointhecircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program, 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. That's 101mixingtricks.com. And you can learn a whole lot more about it. It's pretty cool. I think you'll like it. My guest today is Dave Thomas of Advanced Audio Electronics. He was the former owner of Ocean Sound Studios in Vancouver, which is one of the best studios in Canada and one of the most used by major, major clients. So he has a lot of experience working with major clients, working on big projects. And through all that, he learned a lot about vintage microphones. And he's now applied what he's learned to his new line of microphones at Advanced Audio Microphones. I spoke with Dave via Skype while he was in Mexico. I'm here today with Dave Thomas from Advanced Audio Mics. And thank you so much for being here, Dave. This is great. I'm a big fan and I really wanted to talk to you.
Well, thanks for inviting me on. And I love to talk about my mics. So this is a pleasure for me.
And we will talk a lot about them, but I want to go back to before you were a mic maven, to Ocean Sound Studios. So that was really a big studio in Vancouver. It's one of the biggest ones in Canada in terms of prestige, I think, right?
Well, I think, yeah, for the West Coast, it was, there was Mushroom Studios, and then there was us, and then later some other studios came along. Ocean started, it was back in 1971, and I should go back just a little bit further. At the age of 14, I had a ham radio license, so I was always interested in electronics and music, and I used to, because I was listening shortwave radio, I heard music from all kinds of different, you know, I love the blues, and you could pick up radio stations that were from New Orleans and Memphis. And so I liked music, and I loved electronics. So I got in high school, I got a job in a radio repair shop. And back then everything was tubes. So I was repairing, you know, radios. And it turned out that the guy I worked with, the technician, he actually came from England, and he was trained by Blumfeld. Like the, you know, the guy who had something like 200 audio patents by the time he was 40.
Oh, Blumlein.
Invented airplane radar and the Blumlein pair, and he invented the record cutter and all that. So he'd worked for him in some technical, part of his team, I guess. So then I got into, and then I always was the kid in high school that ran the film projector and, you know, the tape recorder. So out of high school, I got a job at the Vancouver School Board in the audiovisual department. And I was, we were fixing turntables and record players and all the stuff that was in the schools, the PA and the microphones. So even then, back then in 65, when I started working there, I was, you know, taking mostly dynamic mics at that point, but repairing them. And then I got into, as soon as I got my first job, I loved music. I wanted to learn to play an instrument, so I bought a set of drums and took drum lessons. Quickly finding out that I was much better at fixing the guitar amps for the guitar player and mixing the sound than drumming. You know, I could kind of get by, but when I heard other drummers, you know, watch them, and I think that's part of, you know, when you start doing something really young. I got a couple of friends who started playing drums at, you know, 7 or 8, right, who were incredible musicians. And I think you have to start really young. Yeah. And I think it was my playing around with electronics at such a young age that, I'm not afraid to open anything up. And I'm able to relate the circuits we use today with the older circuit. I'm able to, you know, actually look at it, you know, Neumann circuit from 1947, the U-47 was designed in 1947, and go, well, you know, yeah, that's a great circuit. That's an amazing circuit for the time, but today we can do better. By 1961, there were much more hi-fi circuits available, you know, circuits that were quieter and you didn't need to use that very expensive VF-14 tube, and you get the same result, if not better. So I was able to, you know, come up with see those comparisons, you know. And I got on the school board after 2.5 years because I ended up playing in this little basement band at a rock festival. And what happened is the guy who was mixing the sound on the one stage had dropped acid, and he thought he could have been mixing muffins, you know. He had no idea what was going on. So I jumped in, and after we played our first little set in the first afternoon, I started mixing the sound. And so I got hired by the sound company later on. And I think I made, this is 1968, something like that. And I got $250 for the weekend. And I thought I died and gone to heaven. It was like, wow, $250. So I ended up working for them doing live sound. Ended up, we provided backline in Vancouver. Repaired the Marshalls for Led Zeppelin, because they came from England for their first North American tour, did Portland and Seattle with rented amplifiers, and their Marshalls arrived in Vancouver, but they had British plugs wired for 220 volts. So Alex and I had to completely rewire the Marshalls before they could play their set. So, and you know, we did backup for Zappa and you know, all the bands of that time. And so I was working in this music store, and I bought this 4-track tape machine, and I built a little mixer, the first solid, you know, I think a little PA mixer and modified it so we could record with it. And I got hired by a guy named Ralph Dyke, who invented MIDI. Ralph passed away last year, but he was one of the developers of MIDI. Mm-hmm. He programmed all the stuff on Toto's Africa.
Wow.
I was actually talking to Al Schmidt at the AS convention about Ralph, you know, how brilliant Ralph was and what an incredible musician and composer he was as well. So there was this, he used to play in this jazz trio, and they wanted to record a record live. So they, because I had a four track and he knew I knew about electronics, he hired me. And we recorded this record, and it was a jazz record, and it was fairly successful. And so out of that jazz record, we got a they got a contract to do 26 episodes of a live radio show. So we were recording on the four track every week. We'd record this live jazz show with different guest musicians from the Vancouver area, generally. And the studio that had mixed the record, I just recorded the four tracks, and it was mixed at a place called Total Sound West. They were too busy to be able to do the radio show, so we ended up building the first version of Ocean Sound, which was in a like double car garage. And I think we bought I saw a picture of it the other day. Anyway, the mixer that we had, you know, we thought it was 16 channels and four buses, and we thought it was pretty high tech at the time. So that's how I started, you know, in the studio. Then Ocean went from, in 1971, it went from four track. By 1973, we had an eight track Scully machine, and then I went to New York in 75 and bought a 16 track tape machine from Bell Sound. Got to see the Putnam Chambers at Bell Sound, which was pretty amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember hearing the reverb in the control room. He was doing a demo for a band, and I said, "Man, who tunes your plates? Those are the smoothest I've heard." He said, "Oh no, those are Chambers down in the basement," and took me down to see them. And that was just a speaker and two microphones, and you move the mics a little to change the decay reverb time. So. Then I think in 19, we're still in the double car garage, and then we ended up buying a used Studer 24 track in 1978. And I think we paid $55,000 for it used.
Wow. Yeah. Those are the days. Wow.
Yeah. And then we thought, geez, you know, this double car garage is maybe a little small because we had. Steve Picaro come up from Toto and play bass on a track because Ralph was producing it and he'd work with Toto. So, so we ended up building Ocean Sound in 1979. It had two matching control rooms that were 16 feet by 22 feet and two rooms, two studios, the B room and the A room. And it was about 1979 where Ocean became, what I call a full-fledged studio. We had ended up in the end with two 24-track tape machines and two Trident Series 80 consoles, and you know, we had ended up with a couple of U47 microphones. Now, one of the learning about, you know, the Neumann U47s is, well, I was the guy who fixed everything in the studio, but we'd bought one from a studio in Toronto that decided they wanted all the new solid state microphones, you know, like 87s and they sold off their tube stuff, and I think we bought this U47 for $350. This was 1979. And then the other one, somebody found in the basement of a house. I think this guy was a retired CBC technician, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and they'd mounted this 47 that the connector had broken on a little board for him and put a plaque on it and given it to him, I guess, as a retirement present, right? Thinking it would never work again. So anyway, we bought it for, I think we gave this guy like $100 cash and three SM57s.
Oh.
And I ended up building a power supply for that one and replacing the connector. And so then we ended up with two 47s. So, and then we had 414 EB microphones, two of those, which we bought brand new. We bought those when we were in the original little double car garage studio. And I love the 414s. And then we had five U87s. We ended up with, we had two. One was used all the time for voiceover for jingle recording. And then the other one floated around between the two studios. We got a contract to do some animation, and they, the animation company, we were doing all the dialogue, all the, using Vancouver actors, which, interesting, the Vancouver actors, you know, they can do a lot of different accents, which is what they wanted. So I had to go out and buy three more. On the contract, it specified U87s must be used on the voice actors, and we only had two, so I had to go out, and one lived in the other, in the voiceover booth, so we had to buy four more. And even back then, they were $1,800 each, and
yeah.
And that was like my mortgage payment for a year, and I thought, why are they so expensive? There's like $25 worth of parts in these mics, not counting the body and the capsule, you know. My other thoughts at that time were, I had the 47s, and of course they had this really old VF-14 tube, and I thought, well, what am I going to do if one of the tubes fails in the U-47? I can't, we can't afford, even back then, I think they were $500-$600 for a working VF-14.
Yeah.
So I had come up with an idea, you know, how to replace the tube with something else and that would be as good, if not better, you know, an alternate to the VF-14. So that's how I got into, you know, so Ocean was quite successful. Actually, a funny story is that I worked with Katie Lang in 1985. I recorded the music and all the vocals and mixed a tune, Open Your Heart, which was a fundraiser to provide funds for starving children in Africa. And it won an Oxfam Canada award. And then 3 years later, she came back in the studio, in my studio, with Roy Orbison and recorded Crying.
Wow.
But I was in L.A. at the time buying gear for this animation series. So when I came back to the studio, the guys said, oh, man, you never guess who was in here. You know, like the best pop vocalist ever, you know. And I said, well, I don't know who. And so finally, and they said, you know, we figured out it was Roy Orbison. And I didn't believe them. I said, yeah, pull my other leg. There's bells on that one. I never believed Roy was in my studio singing to the U-47 that, you know, I'd maintained. So, and then I think a year later, there was a Grammy came to the studio for that. So,
wow, that's excellent.
So I know what good vocalists sound like in U-47s. You know, that was the, I guess by 1991, I came down here to Mexico for a vacation. My wife and I decided to get away, just the two of us. Our kids had grown up and were in their last year of high school. So at that point, I thought, you know, I'm going to get out of the studio. You know, everything was starting to go digital. I really liked music recording, and we were doing cartoons nonstop, which is fun at first, but it's brute force mixing. You know, it's effects full up, music full up, or dialogue, right? There was no finesse in it, really. So, and I wanted to do something else. So I went back to university for a few years, and so this is how I got into building microphones. Was that I loved the thing I loved the best. Not only did we do this one live jazz show at Live from Puccini's, a series of 26, but a couple of years later, we got hired by a local jazz FM station to go out and record some every Friday a live jazz radio station at different venues in Vancouver. I got to record Mose Allison, Diana Krall when she was 21. I was talking to Al Schmidt about that. I said, geez, Al, I recorded Diana when she was 21, and I got her on a local radio show, and so somebody probably discovered her from that, and then you record, you know, she went down to L.A. to record, and you won Grammys. He said, yeah, I recorded 12 records with her.
Wow, yeah.
So, So I love doing these. I get to record Etta James live for those. And so I think we probably did 150, 200 of these live radio shows. So I missed that live recording. And I've got friends who are great jazz musicians in Vancouver. So I thought, well, I'm going to get some microphones for myself and just go out and record them live. And I ended up getting the first friend of mine worked at the music store, and he came by one day with this Apex 460 microphone. They just Apex is owned by Long McQuaid Music in Canada. So they were the first importers of, you know. So he brought this mic over, and I opened it up and went, wow, it has a real tube. And I drew out the circuit and went, yeah, it's like the front end of a C12 or an ELM251. But then I went, well, it's not exactly the right tube. They put a 12AX7 in there, which is twice the gain, but they make those in China. What I've discovered about China is that everything they build has to be made in China, right? So yeah. We actually send them the tubes. So we send them, we buy 60, 72A tubes from Softec for our microphones, and then we buy them pre-tested, and then we test them all again. Then we send them to China so they can install them. So I took this 460 apart, and then I went, well, I'm going to change the circuit. And then I, at that point, found John Paluzzo, and I bought a Paluzzo capsule and put it in, and I put a SIMAG transformer in, and then I would take them over to a studio to record or live. I actually ended up going back in the studio and recording a jazz group in my friend's studio, and then he wouldn't give me the mics back. He said, let me try those for a while, and then he called me a couple weeks later and said, I'm buying them from you, and bill me another one. So people would go in the studio and sing a vocal, Craig Northey from The Odds, and he would say, can you build me one of those mics? So by 2000, this is around 2000 by this time, 2001 maybe, I was building two or three, buying these retail pretty much, and buying two or three microphones a week and completely rebuilding them. So finally I found the factory that was making these microphones, the lab in Shanghai, and I asked them, I said, look, can you make changes to these microphones? Can you put, you know, those capsules that you machine for John Paluzzo, can you skin them with 6 micron mylar and put them in the microphone? Here's what the changes I want you to make, and I'll send you the tubes, and can you wind me a transformer that's a dual bobbin bimetal with a 5-to-1, between a 5-to-1 and 8-to-1 ratio? And they said, yes, we can do that, but it will be more money. And I went, yeah, okay, well, tell me how much. And it almost took, I think, a couple of weeks before they finally got back to me and said, oh, it'll be $50 more a microphone. I said, just do it.
Yeah,
and we were just buying, you know, maybe, they're a fairly small company. They have 20 employees. The engineer, Mr. Xu, very brilliant guy. They were really willing to work with me, and I would send them schematics and pictures, and the export manager, she was the interpreter. She spoke English. As a matter of fact, we went over and met them last February. Spent a couple of days there working on a couple of new models, and they took us out to the metal. Interesting, when they took us out to the metalwork factory in Shanghai, which is a city block square. It's in the outskirts of Shanghai. I think it's in the next province, just over the border. It was because it was about a 45-minute drive on the freeway. We go in and we see that they make 80% of the world's microphone bodies are made in this one factory. And we
That's
why it takes us so long to get the metalwork made. So that was a great thing about the trip. What we did is we decided, well, we'll just have them make 200 of all our bodies, you know, and have the mic lab that's in downtown Shanghai hold those parts for us. And so when we want, we just put in an order for another 50 CM67SCs, right? So they were actually able to deliver a dozen to me within 10 days, and the rest will come by boat. So we've been able to, you know, up the production, keep the quality, keep improving the quality, you know.
Yeah.
They know now that I don't accept, you know, they know I test every capsule. I send stuff back if it's, you know, not quite right. I actually send them a note saying, here's how you can make an improvement. And we were there at the factory working with them on some different things. We're slowly, I think by next year, all our shock mounts will actually be threading on. We won't have any more. Right now, our CM12, 12SE, and CM251, it's got a great shock mount, but you have to use a flathead screwdriver to clamp the shock mount on.
Yeah.
And so we will have, by next year, those will be thread. We just changed our CM47 FET so that it's now a threaded, more heavy-duty shock mount. It doesn't slip into the little spring sleeve anymore. We've changed those.
Well, I have a bunch of questions for you. First of all, I want to go back to when you got your first two U-47s, and then right. You bought your 87s, so you had a number of them. Did you notice a difference in the sound between them?
Yes.
And how did you determine which sounded better and why?
Well, most of the time the U-87s were used for voiceover or voice work. What you discovered with them was that they worked really well. See, they were designed originally for spot miking orchestras. And if you put them on percussion, we had a Yamaha C7 grand piano. If you put the 87s, sounded nasty if you put them over the hammers of a Yamaha piano. The 414s, they could handle more sound pressure, it seemed like. Like 414s always on percussion, drum overheads. Besides the difference in the response of the capsules are different, right? The C414 is an edge fed, CK12 capsule, while the 87 has a center fed capsule, and they have a slightly different response curve. But we discovered that the 87s were really a bit headroom shy. You know, they were. And Neumann had no idea people were going to use them for rock and roll vocals or, you know, stick them over drum kits. And they'll work on a jazz drummer, but you get a rock guy that's pounding and you want to bring the mics in a little close, to get rid of a bit of the room sound. They just didn't work. I remember working with a guy named Too Loud McLeod, who was a singer-songwriter for the... a Chilliwack, and he also had his own punk band called the Headpins, and he had some pretty big hits in Canada. Darby Mills, the singer, we were using an 87 on her, and I said, I thought it was really nasty sounding. If you soloed up the vocal, I was embarrassed that somebody might solo it up and go, oh, whoever recorded this did a really bad job, because it was so bad, because she's screaming into this 87. And so Brian McLeod, I said, Brian, maybe we should use the U-47 on her. And he said, oh, no. He said, I need that nastiness because it's got to cut through thundering bass, drums, and guitar. You know, this is punk, pop punk. So I thought, oh, okay, he's the producer. So... and then I heard it on the radio a few years later, and the vocals sounded just fine because it get masked by all those, all that thundering bass and drums. So I went, well, that's interesting that, a microphone that from a techno, really I'm a technician first. So when I record as an engineer or I'm sort of co-producer, I have to put on a different hat, right? Like I have to go, well, I always wanted to use the most hi-fi sounding mic, the one that's the cleanest. I would have used, say, the 47. Of course, will take more level because of the tube circuitry.
Yeah.
And so that was interesting. That the 87 actually its brittleness and nastiness actually worked in the favor of this particular production. So that's what I found. The 87 uses, the reason they can even get away with using a single FET driving a transformer is that they use negative feedback to bring down the rise in the capsule. The 87 center-fed capsule rises, it, 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 it starts to rise up maybe around 6 kilohertz, and by 12 kilohertz, it's up 6 to 8 dB.
That much,
so they
really.
So there's this negative feedback to reduce that rise in the high end. And also, because of the limited headroom of the single FET, you know, if you've got an extra 6 dB at 12 kilohertz, it's going to overdrive the amplifier, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The 47, because of the K47 capsule, has a different construction. It's center fed, but it's got random drill pattern and a single backplate. So it has very little, you know, maybe a couple of dB rise at 10 kilohertz, and then it slowly starts to roll off. And it has a little more rise between about 2 to 3. On average, they rise about 2 to 3 dB between 3 and 5 kilohertz in cardioid.
Yeah. You know, I'm with you, but let's back up for a second.
Sure.
What I meant was, did you hear the difference between the two 47s or between the five U87s?
Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. There was a difference between, you know, probably maybe nearly 4 dB, it sounded like to me, you know, at least 3 dB difference between one and the other. Now, they both sounded good, but one was brighter and one had a little bit more low end.
And why was that? Did you determine why that happened?
Well, one was made in 1953, and one was made in 1958. So the one in 58 was a Mylar capsule, and the one in 53, I don't think the capsule had been changed. It was a M7 capsule, PVC. Neumann changed to Mylar in 1958 because they were having so much trouble with the M7s, the PVCs. The PVC has a much shorter life. Like, it starts to lose its elasticity, and it gets the membrane gets brittle, especially from the amount of heat a 47 develops. Not only does the metal clad VF14 get quite warm, but they also used in the bottom of the U47, there is a wire wound resistor, and its job is to drop the filament voltage so that the VF14 is actually running on about 50 volts. Most tubes today run on 6 to 12 volts. A lot of them you can select them, make them run at 6.3 volts or 12.6. Like the 6072 has dual filaments, and you can parallel them or series them.
Mm-hmm.
So that heated up, but it allowed the tube, the filament voltage to slowly come up to the right voltage, and that's why the tubes in them lasted so long. So that's one of the reasons they sound different, is because of not. If you have a brand new M7, because I've done this, I've had some brand new M7s from Geffel and put them up against a brand new, you know, really new K47, and guys with good ears, like a guy named Stu Goldman, used to play John McLaughlin's keyboard player. He has a studio near where I live, scores movies day in and day out. I repaired a Geffel for him. We could hear a slight difference between my 47 VE and his Geffel with the M7, but we like my mic, and, you know, in the mid, maybe a bit more, and, you know, the differences are so subtle. It was like just be the difference between one Geffel UM92 and the next, you know. It was very, very close. So, but when those capsules get older, they actually, you know, the M7s will change quite drastically, you know.
Well, that brings up sort of a philosophical question then. If the sound of vintage microphone is so revered, and yet its sound has deteriorated from what it should have been originally, the baseline of what it should have been originally, what does that say about people who want that particular sound versus something that's better? And which, again, brings me to a second question for you, which is, do you design, because you're looking at copies, basically, of the older vintage mics, are you designing them like they're supposed to be, their baseline, or a new improved version?
Yeah, well, I guess it's more like a new improved version because first of all, you know, you've got to deal with the VF-14 tube, and you know they're we're not going to spend weeks trying to find a good one, and they're $1,000 each. You know, so you've got to find. There is no tube, other tube that can do what the VF-14 does. You know, which I agree with because it was basically where it came from was the front end of a Second World War German tank transmitter. They were meant to run on batteries in a tank. They were the mic, the carbon mic that they talked into that went into a VF-14 as the preamp. So, and then what they did is they basically selected VF-14s, you know, that were quieter. When that's the only tube Neumann could find in 1947 when they brought the U-47 into production. So that's the thing. So I went, well, how, you know, we could build like a single. And how they build that that circuit is actually it's a pent what they call a pentode tube. It has five elements, but they wire it as a triode. So I could use a 6072, but the 6072 ends up having a much higher plate resistance than the VF-14. It works out the VF-14 the way they use it has probably got a plate an output impedance of about 6,000 ohms. And a 6072 in an say a ELAM 251 will have a plate resistance of 20,000 ohms. And what that means is in the C12 of the ELAM 251, you got to use a transformer with a 14-to-1 turns ratio. And so a 14-to-1 turn ratio will have 14 to 16 dB more loss than a 5-to-1 transformer.
Yeah.
So you have to deal with those. So what I discovered was that you could use, as a matter of fact, the Chinese had actually done this in the 460. They'd used a dual, a 12AX7, which is a dual triode, and they'd use the first half as the head amplifier to match the capsule. And they used the second half as a cathode follower to drive the output transformer. The advantage of this is that you get, it's a two-stage circuit. So you get the transformer, you've got an output impedance of 600 ohms instead of, 10 times better than the U47. The problem is they used the wrong tube. They used a 12AX7 and they used a very economical transformer. That's one of the reasons they used that circuit, because they were trying to build these cheap, you know.
I see. Yeah. I
went to Long McQuaid at one point when I started making the mics, and I said, look, why don't I build you a flagship model, you know, one that's got improved capsule? And they said, oh, no, you know, 90% of our sales are on microphones in the store are $300 or under. So they wanted to keep the price of the 460 under $300. So the other thing is they put, there's two capacitors they put across the output transformer, and they'd copied it from some Neumann circuit. And the idea was it was to keep any radio frequencies. You know, back in the 50s and 60s, we had taxi cabs and the AM radio, and they wanted to keep any RF interference from getting into the microphone. Well, somebody had made a mistake on the original schematic, and they put the wrong value capacitor. And still today, I open up 460s, and they've got a 0.1 microfarad instead of a 0.001. We actually cut those capacitors out. We don't even put them in because we don't need them. We've never, I think, out of, I don't know how many microphones of those I actually upgraded in the microphones we sell with transformer outputs. I've only had one guy ever say he's picking up radio stations. I don't think that in that case, really, it was the microphone, right? So we've never ran into that issue. So we, less is more, you know, how I design stuff is less is more.
What's the toughest thing about building a mic? Again, you're talking about, if I hear you correctly, there's basically, well, four things that are important. It's the capsule, there's the circuitry, there's the transformer, and then, of course, if it's a tube mic, then there's the tube.
Right.
So which is the most important of all these, and which is the toughest for you to actually get together in terms of manufacturing?
Well, the capsules probably, because you have to be very, the capsules are mechanical, so you have to check the quality control needs to be. What we do is I actually pay Shanghai a couple of dollars more a capsule than maybe some of the other people, and I have them run all my capsules as soon as they're skinned. And I was there. These girls are so skilled working on these capsules. I work on microphones all day, and how quickly they can put all those little screws that hold the ring over the diaphragm is amazing, you know. But we have them put every one in a little standalone anechoic chamber and run a frequency response. So we have a curve, which is our benchmark curve that we want that. Particularly they're building me a K47 capsule, you know, it needs to have no more than a 3 dB rise in the mid range, and it should be, you know, flat or up 2 dB at 10K, you know, and the capacitance between the front and the back should be within 2% of each other. So, you know, they will run, probably what they do with other people is they won't run every one in the, you know, they will. When they're first starting to make, say they're going to make a batch of center-fed, K47 type or center-fed 67 type capsules, they'll build up a couple and they'll run a couple through to make sure those ones look good, and then they'll bang the rest of the runoff. We have them test every one, you know, for us, and it does only takes. We watch them; it takes like 5 minutes at most. They've put the capsule in. They've got a microphone inside the chamber, and they just put the two wires into two little clip-on connectors, and they just sit it on the saddle. They don't even have to screw it on, and they run the response curve, you know, for us. So the capsule is very, very important because it's the heart, you know, it's where it's taking the sound waves and changing them into electrical energy. The other thing about the capsules is it's much harder to make a K47 than the 67. This is the other reason Neumann went to the K67 in the U87. What they do is that there's two separate backplates. So they skin one half of it, and they test the capacitance, and they skin the other half. So what they do is they're basically skinning, single-sided capsules, and then they measure those, and the ones that match, so if one measures 80 picofarad capacitance, they find another one that's 79 to 81 picofarads, and they put those two together. You might get one that's, say, 78 and another one that's 82, you know, so they won't put those together. That's the problem with the K47 is it's a single back plate. They got to skin both sides. So if the front and the back don't match, you know, they could be further apart, and some people might let that go, you know, but with ours, we say, you know, they've got to be, the front and the back have to match, you know.
You just answered a question I've had for a long time, which is, I was always under the impression that the big difference between a 67 and an 87 was the fact that one had a tube in it, a tube electronics, and the other one is solid state. But that's not the case.
The capsules are entirely different. Yeah, I mean, I could send you we've got capsules that we rejected. I can send them to you. You can see that there's a single backplate on the K47, and what I did, I had I think it was a U47, a real U47 I was repairing for somebody, and the capsule just failed, like the gold had come off the, so I actually a few years ago sent that to China and said, can you make these, and they actually, within 2 weeks, they sent me a sample back. That's how quickly they work.
Wow.
John Palooza told me a story. When he first started making capsules, he had tried to get an American company to do the millwork, to actually build the metal backplates, drill all the holes. And he said, a year later, he still hadn't got any samples, you know. So he finally flew to China and worked with them, because they'll get on it right away. And so,
wow, amazing.
Probably because if you're not, you know, they're set up in the U.S. They want to run big lots of something. Who knows what they're machining, you know, and we're only asking to build, you know, 200 capsules, you know, every 3 months, maybe, you know.
Yeah, sure. What's your favorite microphone?
Well, it depends on, you know, it's funny. Even me, I get a bit elitist sometimes, right? And I build my CM47 FET, and I thought, I only build mics that I would use in the studio. That's my one line. If I won't use it myself, we don't build it. But my U47 FET, my CM47 FET, I thought, okay, this is my introductory professional level microphone. You know, I wanted to build a mic that was under $300. It sells for $295 now, because used to be, I think we sold them for $289 or $279, but we've actually improved the shock mount. And I, for the longest time, I never used one, because I always had, you know, U47, my CM47 or my CM414 or something. And then, I don't know, I ended up using one day, and I went, wow, it sounded better than I expected it to sound, from, because it's my introductory level mic, right? I've been using it in front of kick drum, just like the real guy. And I've got people sending me files, and John Smeltz, who's recording Jill Scott right now, is using my 251 on her vocals, but he uses my 47 FET, you know, in front of the kick drum, and he said he used it on horns for an Al Green recording. And
yeah. So, what's the most popular mic that you sell?
Well, I don't have the stats here, because I'm not in the office, because I can pull them up really quickly. But we do sell a lot of 47 FETs, CM47 FETs, because they're, you know, they'll take, I mean, they've been used on Jennifer Hudson vocals, because it'll take so much love. What I did with the CM47 FET, backtrack just a little bit, is that I realized that the kind of, you know, a lot of people that are going to be using them are entry level people that, you know, a project studio, excuse me. People with project studios are going to get the CM47 FET, and they're probably going to be using it into an M-Audio preamp, an average sort of transformless preamp. They're going to be in their bedroom, which is fairly echoey, so they're going to have to get right in on top of the microphone. They're not going to they're going to have a window to the outside world where cars go by. So I reduced the gain of the circuit about 3 or 4 dB, so that the microphone doesn't put out as much level as my 87 or my 47 tube mic, and the capsule's a 32 millimeter, so it puts out about 2 to 3 dB less level than our edge fed capsule or the K60 or AK67 capsule. So it will take a heck of a lot of level, you know, and it'll be gentler on your preamp. Now, all my FET mics, I use the same circuit. I don't copy because I use a two-stage circuit. As I said, I found the best FET mic that I've used was the original 414 EBs. They use a two-stage. Again, it was really interesting, because when I looked at the circuit, I went, oh, there we go. That's a cathode. It's called an emitter follow in a transistor, but they do the same thing. They use the FET at the capsule end, and they use the emitter of another transistor to drive the output transformer. Still all class A, but it's a two-stage circuit, so it has much more headroom. You use a 2-to-1 transformer instead of a 10-to-1. The U87 has a 10-to-1 transformer in the output, which means you're losing 14 dB of level. So you have to bring the gain of the first stage up 14 dB. So what we did with our CM47 FET or our 414 or our 87, we used a two-stage circuit, 2-to-1 output transformer. We dropped the gain of the first stage 14 dB. So we have 14 dB more headroom right out of the gate.
Wow.
And the two-stage circuit is class A. So you're not losing, you know, any, you know, quality. What's interesting about, so anyway, back to the original question. So I think the capsule first, once you get the capsule where you've got consistency from one capsule to the next, then you're off to the ballpark. Once you find a circuit, you know, I was able to say to improve the circuit. The other thing today that, you know, I shake my hat at some of these guys that they, you know, when I read go on gear slots and they go, oh, nothing sounds like those old mics, all those old components. I go, those components were horrible. I was there in the 60s fixing, you know, home stereos for people, tube stereos. And you were lucky to get resistors that had 10% tolerance.
Yeah,
and
I remember.
Carbon resistors, when you heat them up over a year, they would change their value another 10%.
Yeah.
Today, computers manufacture all the parts. They're so we're using 1% resistors in our microphones. The U47 tube mic, there's no regulation on the power supply. So it's why we just fixed. I just rebuilt a real U47 for a guy in Chicago a few weeks ago, and it took. I was measuring the supply voltage to the tube. It took 45 minutes for that the voltage to get. To finally stop moving. You know, when I first put the capsule was really good in this U47. The only problem with it is the connectors, the little connector at the bottom of the microphone, the blades were actually black. And the same with the two connectors in the head grill that you undo three screws in the head, the whole head comes off and there's two connectors. Those are black. So I actually had to take, my wife works for a dentist, and I actually took one of the dental hygienist tools, a scraper they scrape your teeth with when they're getting the plaque off. I use that to scrape off the black, and then we put a contact cleaner on them. So the mic came back to life, but it sounded, compared to my 47 FET VE, my mic blew it away when you first plugged in the U47. 45 minutes later, they were really close. You know, you would go, oh, okay, I hear, you know, there's a subtle difference, but that's the difference you would probably hear brand new, you know, whether it was a brand new U47 compared to another brand new U47 or compared my 47 VE to you know, another brand new one.
Yeah.
Those subtle differences we were hearing, but it took almost an hour for the 47 to get to that point. You know, mine, they're up to temperature within 2 minutes because we're using today we're using solid state regulators to hold the voltage. Filament's always at 6.25 volts. So I can't remember finding a 6072 that the filaments failed in. You know, that it's, because if Jeez. Back in the day, the filaments would burn out because the voltage would go high.
Right. What's the one mic you still would like to build?
It's funny. I never owned or heard an M49, right?
Yeah.
And when I was in LA at the AS show, Joseph McGee, who's the supervising music mixer for Sony Pictures, he's got a bunch of our mics and loves them. Now, one of the things he said he loves our mics is because. If he's doing this movie called Pitch Perfect 2, and it's young kids singing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes he goes into Warner Brothers studio to record their vocals, or not Warner Brothers, Western. And if he can't get that studio, he has to go somewhere else. And he likes 47s. So he said, the thing is, if I take your 47 VE with me, it's consistent, sounds the same. But he said, if I go, you know, to the mic at one studio sound different than the other one. Then he has to try to match that together in editing, right?
Yeah.
So he says he loves my mics because they're so consistent. So he asked me, he said, I love M49s. Could you build me an M49? And I said, yeah. He said, well, how long would it take you to build one? I said, about half an hour. He said, I'm going to use my circuit. I'm not going to look for an AC701 tube. You know, because I know the circuit we use is got more headroom, has got more clarity. And I said it's a K47 capsule with an 87 head grill. So it's got a trapezoidal head grill, and that's what changes the sound. Plus, the M49 has five patterns, or nine patterns, you know. And yeah. All our tube mics, we use a nine-pattern power supply. So I sent one down to him, I built one up in a day. Well, it took me a little longer than half an hour because I actually had to redo some machining to the head grill to get it to fit on my 47 body. But we figure out how to do that now. So I sent it to him, and 2 days later, he said, I just put it up against the two M49s at Western, and he said it's spot on.
Wow.
Said. So, you know, so I was looking, and then somebody, we sent one to my dealer, to Mike. I don't know if you met Mike in Europe. Great no. guy. Speaks five languages. He's a tech also. So he gave one to, I forget who the guy, a guy in England, and they recorded saxophone with it. And he said, that's the sound. I've been looking for that Paul Desmond sound on my saxophone, and that Mike gave it to me, you know. So,
wow. Yeah, there you go.
So now we're looking, people keep asking me about a C800, you know, can you build me a, because all the rappers use the C800. But I think it should sound like my 67 SE because it's basically a center-fed K67 cap. When I look at the response curve of that mic, but I think it's a bit nastier sounding, and that's what they like about it. You know, it's a bit edgier. So we're sort of playing around right now. Scotty, while I'm away, was, you know, trying a couple of different capsules, a couple of different things to see if he can get a mic to sound a little bit edgier, a little bit nastier.
Yeah.
A little bit more rise on the top end for the rap guys, right?
So, yeah. Last question. Thank you for spending so much time. This has been terrific. I spent too much of your vacation time here.
Oh, that's okay. But I'm happy to talk about microphones. I'm looking out. It's not where I live in Canada. It's a lovely place in the summer. We're surrounded by wineries and vineyards and orchards, but it's I think it went down to I'm trying to think what it is in Fahrenheit, but I think it's around -4 Celsius right now. So
that's cold, yeah.
22 degrees Fahrenheit or something. It's a little chilly there. So I'm just happy to look out at the blue skies, and it's, I think, about 78 degrees here Fahrenheit today. So.
Yeah, that's nice. What's the best piece of business advice that you either received from someone or that you've learned in your years in the business?
Well, I think, you know, what works for us is that we sell directly. And I was been approached, you know, to have dealers. And, yeah, your sales increase. But it's having the direct contact with the musicians. You know, when I get, you know, one, it does your ego, you know, really. When somebody like, you know, Jack Douglas, who, you know, recorded Double Fantasy, comes to us at the AS show and says, man, I heard your mic on Jill Scott in Nashville. Send me one, you know, you go. So it's having that direct, you know, because otherwise the company would, you may, you know, come to the show, but you've got salesmen out there, you
yeah,
know.
And, yeah.
Or Joe, you know, meeting Joe, Joseph McGee from Sony and being invited over to Sony Pictures and going, and he takes us to the sound stage where they recorded The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, and being able to, you know, design a mic for him, you know, that from talking with him and my experience, you know, over the years and what his requirements are, you know, to go, oh yeah, we could do that for you. So I think it's, you have to know, I think it, because I know I was a record, you know, I've been a recording engineer, I've been the tech, I understand tube circuits as a kid, you know, it's taking that and using all those experiences. I, you know, really I'm sort of, you know, I never made any money owning a studio. As most people have studio, they'll tell you, it's all about buying gear, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, we went from 4-track to 8-track to 16-track to 24-track to digital, you know, and you're always buying more gear. And
yeah,
so now
yeah.
that I'm selling microphones, I have much more disposable income than I did. And the other thing is embrace the internet. You know, what we found that helps us greatly is that we use a program, you know, called Shopify. Now, it just allows us to change things instantly on our webpage. You know, I say when we have Jack Douglas come by, so we can, there's a picture of me and Jack, and immediately goes on our webpage.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's we don't need to buy, you know, $1,000 ads in magazines. You know, we it's word of mouth. It takes longer. I mean, I've been building mics since, 2001. So I think 2003 is where I sort of said, okay, now I'm going to be this little microphone company. So it's taken 10 years to get to the point, where, I feel like we've kind of made it as a microphone company. We're up there with people are actually choosing our mics over mics costing five times as much money, where they put thousands of dollars of marketing behind them. Throw away your marketing. I see a lot of this stuff where the microphones are built by people who have taken marketing courses.
Yeah, right.
I know nothing about marketing, but I know a lot about electronics,
I can say that I'm a happy advanced audio microphone owner myself. And, I think they're great. I just used one last night in a vocal, and it was terrific, as I thought.
The other thing is that we stand behind what we do. If you have a problem with your mic, send it to me. We'll repair it. If a guy buys if he buys my CM47 and he says, my 47 VE are different. My 47 is my version of what I thought a 47 really should be. It opens up more at 12K. What I found is doing pop vocals, even when I recorded Katie Lang, that in the mix, we would quite often with a U47 open up 12K about 3 dB with the old Pultec 2BQ. Just add a little air on the top to get the vocal to cut through.
Yeah.
So what I did is I built a 47 with the 47. The head grills change the sound 2 to 3 dB. They can a 47 cylindrical head grill tends to null out something around 8K. It dips that a little bit. The trapezoidal head grill, it has a smoother high end. It lets the high end rise. The difference, we use the same capsule in my CM47 as my CM67SE, same circuit, but the 67SE is 2 dB brighter up at 12K than my 47, which is up about 4 dB at 12K.
Yeah.
Now, Chuck Ainley loves the 67SE on vocals, just used it on Liam Womack, Peter Frampton, and Hillary and Charles from Lady Antebellum. Put it up against all the usual suspects in the studio, and they chose that mic as well. So, because if you listen to the Liam Womack mix and their latest record, there's a lot going on, right? And it just allows that vocal to come through. It's got this real sheen on the top end that's smooth, but it just allows the vocals to come right through all the other tracks.
Yeah. Dave, thanks so much for your time. This was great. It was the chat I was hoping to have with you, and it was as good as I had hoped. Thank you so much for your wisdom and microphones.
Anytime.
Thank you, Dave.
All right. Thank you, Bobby.
To find out more about Dave and Advanced Audio Microphones, go to advancedaudio.ca. That's not .com. That's .ca because they're in Canada. Don't forget. Advanced Audio, all one word. .ca. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. And Steve is responsible for putting this podcast together. Thank you, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab. Or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. BobbyOsinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for any new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.